You are listening to The Christian Commute, a commute link podcast about Christian apologetics, theology, and other matters of Christian interest. Here is your host, Seth Dunn.
It is Thursday, November 11th. This is The Christian Commute. I am your host, Seth Dunn, and you were riding home with me on the way to my football banquet. No morning show today because I had a conference call scheduled while I was en route to the office. So I wasn't able to record a show, but I do get the evening show on the way home. Leaving a little early today so I can get prepared for that football banquet. I gotta go pick up my trophies at the house and then go get some pizza. So that's what I'm up to. And this is the last Christian commute of the week, unfortunately, because I took the day off tomorrow. So I took a vacation day Friday and I took a vacation day Monday because I'm going to Augusta for my brother-in-law's wedding. So we have the rehearsal dinner Friday night, the wedding on Saturday, and then by the time that's over, it'll be too late to drive home. So I rented an Airbnb down there. It's the first time I've ever done anything like that. But I'm looking forward to it because it's a farmhouse on a working farm. So it might be kind of neat. And it's outside the city. So I think we'll have a good time, make a little mini vacation out of it. But that's two commutes gone, two work days gone. So no recording. Now listen, there's always the off chance, and I always say this, that I'll record a Christian commute on my way to Augusta, and if I was, or to wherever I'm going on this long trip. If you remember when I drove to the Smokies recently, I did two or three shows, maybe four. One on the way there, two on the way there, and then one or two on the way back. But I will not be alone. I'll be with my entire family. And here's what happens on these trips with my family. I have to drive, and then my wife says, don't turn the radio on or listen to any music or podcasts, or record your own podcast because the baby's trying to sleep and we don't want to wake the baby up. So what I want you to do, Seth, is drive in absolute silence for 4 hours. I'm going to sit here on my phone on Facebook or Amazon shopping while you just drive in silence. That's what's going to happen. But if that's not the case, if I'm able, I might do an episode. We'll see. Today's episode title is Mary, M-A-R-R-Y, not Mary, like I'm happy, like Merry Christmas, or I'm on my merry way. Mary, M-A-R-R-Y, not M-A-R-Y as in Jesus' mom, M-A-R-R-Y, Mary as in when a husband takes a wife. I have a question in the inbox about God's love in the Old Testament and New. And as always, we have the Bible chapter review. We continue in Matthew chapter 7. Come on, get over, Range Rover. Everything's going my way now. Somebody was slow in the left lane and they're getting over. It's a black car. I don't know, maybe white cars go slow in front of you and black cars get over in a considerate manner. Matthew chapter 7, verses 15 through 20. This is what Jesus says. Beware false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Here's the argument. Grapes are not gathered from thorn bushes, nor figs from thistles, are they? So every good tree bears good fruit, but the bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot produce bad fruit, nor can a bad tree produce good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. So then you will know them by their fruits. Okay. I'm just going to go straight to something I've heard people say in the modern day. When they're talking about a well-known heretic or false teacher like T.D. Jakes, or to maybe a lesser extreme, Tony Evans. You say, Seth, you say Tony Evans is a Pelagian. You say Tony Evans doesn't believe in the absolute sovereignty of God. Yeah, but he's not a modalist. T.D. Jakes is a prosperity pimp modalist. So I guess he's a little worse than Tony Evans. So name whoever it is And people like to listen to them, and you'll say, you know, you shouldn't listen to that person. Or you shouldn't have music from that church in your church. That church is a bunch of heretics and false prophets. And what do people say? I'm going to eat the fish and spit out the bones. Eat the fish and spit out the bones. I, for one, eat boneless salmon. I don't like to spit out the bones. But we know this. All of us who've ever caught a wild fish before and our grandma fried it. What do you just got bones in it? There's nobody at the fish factory to debone it for you. Eat the fish and spit out the bones. There's something bad for you on that plate. You don't eat that. All right. Nice saying. But that's a real specious argument. Because here's what Jesus said. A good tree bears good fruit. And a bad tree bears bad fruit. You don't get grapes from the thorn bush or figs from thistles, do you? When you have someone who is a false prophet, all he bears is bad fruit. That he says some good things are not like, all right, he says nine good things and one bad thing, so that's nine pieces of good fruit and one piece of bad fruit. No, no, no. The tree itself only bears bad fruit. The good things he is saying, that's his sheep costume. That makes him more dangerous that he's saying the good things. That makes him look like a sheep. But inside, he's a ravenous wolf. Guys, no quarter for false prophets. No tolerance for false prophets. And the Greek word, and this is interesting because I looked up the Greek word today. I mean, it's prophetes. That's the Greek word for prophet. And I was going to go to Strong's to read the definition when I was making my notes before I left work. And what was interesting to me, and I had never noticed this before, but false prophet in the Greek is not two separate words. It's one. And I think it was like pseudo prophetes. Like, you know how we have our team, our modern term, pseudo. Like we talk about somebody who's a pseudo-intellectual. That's somebody who acts like he's an intellectual, but he's not really that smart. Here's a pseudo-left lane driver. It's this guy in the left lane going super slow. Super slow. And his hood is being held down by a belt. So that's probably why he's going slow. Dude, if your hood's being held down by a belt, maybe drive slow in the right lane. All right. So there's actually one singular Greek term for false prophet. And it's not necessarily somebody coming and making a false prediction that doesn't come true. That would certainly be a false prophet if somebody says, this is going to happen, God told me it was going to happen, and it didn't. That's a false prophecy. But it's generally anybody who comes and he's saying, he's speaking in the name of God and saying, this is what God's message for you is. Not necessarily telling the future, but somebody speaking in the name of God and telling God's message, but he's teaching false things or prophesying false things. And isn't that exactly what a false teacher, like one of these modern day false preachers, does in the pulpit, especially the Pentecostals? God told me this. They get up in the pulpit and they say, I'm here speaking as a man of God, and this is it. But instead they're a prosperity pimp or a Pelagian or you name it. Guys, wolves in wolves' clothing are easy to avoid because they look like ravenous wolves. The reason you have to beware is because they're in sheep's clothing. And what Jesus is saying here, yeah, he's dressed like a sheep, but you can tell if he acts like one or not by whether or not they bear fruit. And I think I hear this voice misappropriated, because people will say, well, I can't see into people's heart. I'm not called to be a judge, but I'm called to be a fruit inspector. And if you say you're Christian, you're not acting like one, I can know you by your fruits. And I guess that's true. But what Jesus is specifically talking about here is not your average run-of-the-mill goat sitting next to you in the pew, or if you go to one of these goat churches, sitting next to you in the padded, removable seat. It's talking about somebody who's carrying himself as a prophet. Oh my goodness. Guess what? There's a white car going too slow in front of me. Oh! And I can't get over because he's on his brakes. I have to pause talking about false prophets. Get over! What is wrong with you? Yes. Now his turn signal's on. You got your signal on. Now get over. You got plenty of room. Oh my gosh, you're a terrible driver. Oh, terrible. All right. Now there's always the risk that when you pass one of these people that you speed up too fast because you're so frustrated about going slow and you end up going 100 miles an hour. No, I just want to go my regular speed. I'm not going to speed up. But you want to blow them away and be like, what's wrong with you? All right. I'm being patient. I get older. I notice being patient. All right, let's talk about false prophets. Jesus makes a very good argument. You get good fruit from fruit trees. Like, what's bad? Thorns and thistles are bad. What do these people eat back then? They eat grapes and figs. If Jesus was preaching this in North Georgia, he would say Honeycrisp apples and Cameo apples, because we grow apples here. Apples and peanuts and Vidalia onions, all right? That's what we grow in Georgia. But he's in Israel, and they eat figs. My wife likes figs. I'm not a fig person. They eat figs and grapes. That's what they're growing. He says, so they all like figs and grapes. And it's very clear. Guys, you get grapes from the vine and figs from the fig tree. You don't get it from a thorn or a thistle. In fact, that'll prick you. That's bad. Good trees bear good fruits. What do grapevines grow? Grapes and only grapes. What do fig trees grow? Figs and only figs. Right? So a good tree bears good fruit, not some other kind of weird fruit. And it's the same thing. A bad tree, thorns and thistles. That's all it produces is thorns and thistles. It's like, oh, here's some thorns and thistles, and here's some maraschino cherries. That's not how it goes. Look out and use some common sense. Use Jesus' argument here to beware of false prophets. They are coming to deceive you. They were coming then, and I believe they're here now. Now let's move on to the question. This question comes from Frank. And he says, basically in a nutshell, does the love portrayed by God in the Old Testament, is that different from the love portrayed by God in the New Testament? And if we're supposed to imitate God and be His people, which love are we supposed to adapt? And Frank says, there seems to be a difference between New Testament love, which is graceful, in Old Testament love, which is behavioral, based on behavior. And what Frank does is he cites blessings and cursings. Because you can see through the Old Testament, choose this day whom you will serve, that type of thing. Israel, when you go into the land that God has given you, if you do this, you will be blessed. If you do this, you will be cursed. And Frank's saying, it seems like that's a transactional love based on what you're doing, not grace. Whereas in the New Testament, we just have this blanket forgiveness, not a license to sin, may it never be, Paul says. We don't want to be antinomian, but it seems like there's just plain grace, and it's not our success or our blessing or cursing, if you will, is not based on our behavior. And to that, Frank, I say, that may be how it seems to you. But let's go to Scripture. The Scripture says that the law and the prophets, all of them are tied up into the two great commandments. The greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. You will love Him with all your heart, mind, and soul. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Where did Jesus get that from? He got that from what at his time was the OT, the only Testament, but what we now call the Old Testament. That's what he says in the New Testament out of Jesus' mouth. That's what we're supposed to do, the greatest commandments, love. Where did he get how to love? He got it from the Old Testament. So if anybody says or makes the argument that God's love in the Old Testament is different than the New Testament, it doesn't hold up to the very words Jesus said, applying what? The Old Testament. Now, when you think of blessings and cursings, Frank, I want you to think very broadly of the ancient Near Eastern culture. Because people talking about blessings and cursings and contracts and covenants was very common. Right? They didn't have the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. They didn't have Bartow County Magistrate Court, Superior Court, Chancery Court, State Court, Supreme Court. Right? They didn't have all that. They might have the king or somebody to judge them. But in all these ancient contracts and covenants, if you do not abide by this, may all these curses befall you. And if you do, may all these blessings befall you. And what God is talking about in that same vein, and in the language they'll understand, talking about blessings and cursings, following the law of God, that in itself is a blessing. You'll remain in the land if you do that. But if you don't, if you follow after other gods, you'll be expelled from the land. That's a cursing. And you think, if you think that's any different now, you're just wrong. Because the Lord chastens the ones He loves. When you're talking about bad things happening, my dad loves me. I know He does. Like, nobody loves me like my daddy. Nobody loves me like my mama, and nobody loves me like my wife. They all love me in their unique way. But I know my daddy loves me. But he spanked me all the time. If I did what my dad said, blessing. If I disobeyed my father, boom, belt, cursing. Why? Because I got a punishment for not following the rules. But you get the punishment from the one who loves you. Sorry, somebody's calling me. I feel like I need to answer. All right, that was an important call I had to take from somebody at work to help him. But now I was on a roll. What was I talking about? I was talking about love, blessings and cursings. Yeah, my dad spanking me. So all those people, like, remember, even in the case of Achan, one guy did something wrong and the people suffered. Hey, let me get out of your way. A Porsche is flying by. I'm not rude. Go by as fast as you want, Porsche. I'm in this little Kia Soul. How dare I take up your room in the fast lane? Ooh, he likes the U. Gross. Oh, it's from Florida. It's the fastest Florida car I've ever seen. God bless you, white car from Florida, driving fast even though you like the U. That's one of those things, if you see a Porsche driving slow, I'm in my little $4,000 Kia Soul, and a $5,000 car drives fast, and what if he's going 50 miles an hour? Like, you might as well have a Kia Soul, dude. Anyway, back to blessings and cursings. In the Old Testament, God's love on Israel is not based upon them doing good or bad. And think about, I mean, that's not even what the Old Testament says. God saves Israel time after time, even though they're wicked, out of His grace, just because they're His people. He says, I picked you. You weren't a numerous people or anything. You didn't do anything to earn getting picked, but I picked you. To paraphrase, I think that's in Deuteronomy, what God says about Israel. So time after time, look at Judges, look at in Egypt. He saves these stiff-necked, obstinate people just out of His grace and His love. Where do the cursings come from? They disobey Him, and they're being chastised. So there's really no delineation at all between Old Testament love and New Testament love. And if you really dig down into the laws, like the not just ceremonial laws or moral laws, but the civil laws in the Old Testament, you'll see how they protect people and how they're meant to do right by everybody. So, in no way is there this idea, if you really pay attention to the Old Testament and New Testament, and especially what Jesus says about the Old Testament, in no way is there any kind of difference there. Even between what? The Old Covenant and the New Covenant. We are under a New Covenant, but that doesn't mean God was any less graceful in the Old. All right, let's go. Oh, let's go to the show topic. Today's show topic is Mary. So yesterday I talked about getting a license to the ministry, and you may know people with a license to the ministry. But what does that especially license them to do? Because I'm a CPA, so I can do your taxes. And I can sign off on a financial statement audit. And the lady at the nail salon can give you a manicure and a pedicure, and your hairdresser can give you a haircut. They're licensed to do a specific thing, that it is illegal if somebody else does it for money. So what's one thing a license lets you do? It lets you marry. Now, the laws at your state may be different than the laws of mine. Georgia's laws basically say you're a minister if your church says you are. And I don't even think that they ask for the license. Richard Brown married me. And he signed our wedding license. And I guess we turned it in.
to this day, I don't know. It could be in the safe deposit box for all I know. I remember going to the courtroom to get it from the judge, the marriage license, and they gave us the paper, and then Brother Richard had to sign it after we got married. And I remember when my brother got married, he got married by a Methodist minister named Sam Parks. And my brother's license in Tennessee had the place for the signature, and it said, I think it said, minister of the gospel or Jewish rabbi. So if you're a Muslim imam, I guess you're out of luck. You can't marry somebody. I don't know. You probably can, but all that to say, nobody's checking that. I don't think anybody's ever going to look at my marriage license and check, like, well, is Richard Brown licensed? At least not in Georgia. It's just showing that somebody married us and there was witnesses, and we got the license from a judge. But broadly speaking, when you get a license to marry, or a license to the ministry, you're someone who can perform marriage ceremonies. And this is interesting to me because here's why. License to preach, nowhere in the Bible. Now here's one for you. Where does it say in the Bible that only a minister, much less a licensed one, or a pastor or a preacher can marry you? Or that is at all his function? So when we look in the New Testament, we see people have wives, and it talks about how to treat your wife and how to treat your kids and how to treat your husband. But there's no direction for, well, this is how to do a marriage ceremony and this is who should perform it. Is there? And I'm just going from memory. Even in the Old Testament, I can't see anything in the Old Testament that says this is who solemnizes marriages. I remember Jacob gets married to Leah and Rebekah, but it doesn't say who's doing the marriage. And by the way, there wouldn't even have been a priest because Laban was a pagan. He had little statues in his house. And then the law had not yet been given to Moses. But somehow, some way, it has become the duty of ministers to marry people. And we know marriage is important. I mean, the Roman Catholics have it as a sacrament. And we non-sacramentalists, we Protestants don't go that far. But we Christians see marriage as a covenant not only between man and wife, but between man, wife, and God, because we're Christians. And it's God who has joined us together. Like what is often said, what God has put together and let no man separate. Who said that? Jesus. And that's echoed in wedding vows and wedding ceremonies. But the Bible is not a how-to book of how to marry people. Now, I took this in seminary. In seminary, you get this training. This is how to do a marriage. You're going to be expected to do a marriage. This is how to do it. And there's little books that have been made. That's why everybody says, everybody almost says the same vows who has a church wedding. I, Seth Dunn, take thee, Laura, to be my lawfully wedded wife, to have and to hold, to love and to cherish, for better or for worse, in richness and poorness, as long as we both shall live. I mean, I think I said that at my wedding. It's on tape, but how many TV weddings have I heard that on? There's nowhere in the Bible that it says to do that. There's actually an early book of how to do things in church that dates from very near to the New Testament period. It's called the Didache. And the Didache is sort of a church manual. This is how you do things. But when you get into, and I don't know if it has anything for weddings, but when you get into, because I've never read it, when you get into the New Testament, it doesn't say pastors or people licensed to minister are supposed to marry people or have that duty or have to. And we look at, in our society, I don't know about other societies, who can marry people? Judges can marry people. The justice of the peace. So when you have a municipality and a judge has been appointed or elected, and one of the things he's authorized to do is to solemnize marriage vows. The mayor can marry people. Like a mayor of the city can perform a wedding ceremony. A ship's captain. I don't know how this got to be. I mean, there's not an ocean in Cartersville. But ship's captains can marry people, and that's recognized. It'd be interesting to know how that came about. And then finally, religious clerics in a Judeo-Christian culture like ours, like the Tennessee marriage license says, a minister of the gospel or Jewish rabbi, but I guess you could throw imam on there or Buddhist monk or I don't know the names of the clergy for all the heretic pagan religions. But you could throw that in there. But why? I don't know. That being said, should you, if you've become quote unquote licensed to marry people, should you do that as a Christian? Now let me give you some personal examples. Because whether you're officially employed at a church or not, if people know you as churchy or religious, you're kind of their de facto guy. Like, yeah, in my plant today, we had a Veterans Day lunch. So the boss asked me to pray. Why'd he ask me to pray? Well, I got a Bible tract on my desk, and I got a seminary paper on my wall. So, number one, I'm the guy comfortable in praying in front of people. Other people might feel uncomfortable praying out loud in front of anybody or anybody at work. But you get to be kind of like the chaplain of the place or your little group of friends or whatever. That just happens, whoever's the churchy guy. And because I'm that in many groups, I've had people ask me to marry them before. Now, a couple years ago, my friend's dad, he was a widower because my friend's mom had died. He called me one night. He says, "Hey, can you come over here and marry me and his fiance?" And I said, "Well, actually, no, I can't because I'm not licensed." And it's funny because I thought he's planning his wedding. Well, I go over there to visit him a couple weeks later and they're married. I'm like, "Well, you just called me to marry you." He's like, "Yeah, I mean, I wanted you to come over tomorrow and do it." Hey, older people will do that. So he called somebody else and they came right over to marry him. So he was just calling ministers he knew. But here's an interesting point with that. Why didn't he call his pastor of his church? Right. And then recently there was a friend of mine at work, a woman that I work with, she was getting married. And she was like, "Hey, can you marry people?" Because she was trying to, "Could you marry us?" And I was like, "Well, no, I'm not licensed." So I told her no. So I don't know who she found. But when people have asked me that, I'm like, there's always in the back of the mind, why aren't you asking your pastor? And I know the reason, because whoever's asking me that is not really a church-going person. And they may go to church every once in a while, but they're not, it's not first in their life. And I hope you know what I mean. Because let me give you an example of, say, me. When my wife and I were going to get married, I just made an appointment with Don Hathaway at Tabernacle and said, "We're getting married on this date." And he says, "Well, I can't do it because I've got a speaking engagement that day." I thought, "Well, can Jonathan or Richard do it?" And Richard did it. And those were the other pastors at the church. And that was the thing. I went to my church to find my clergy guy, the guy in charge of shepherding my soul. And the church had rules where, like, we're going to have to give you counseling. So that, it sets forth this question. And it's not a question that's really laid out for you in the Bible, because there's no such thing as a license to ministry, and there's really no such thing as the command, "Thou shalt be married by a pastor or a preacher or someone, quote unquote, licensed in the ministry." It's just kind of out there. So what do you do if by some reason you find yourself licensed, or if you are employed as a pastor at XYZ church, if somebody who you know isn't a 52 a week a year church-going Christian who lives a Christian life and values Christian marriage in the way you do. Obviously, they value marriage or they wouldn't getting married. What do you do if they ask you? And it's usually going to be somebody who's friends with you. How do you handle that? And the way I've always looked at it has been like this. What I just say is, I can't. I'm not licensed. But now I can't say that anymore. At least I won't be able to say that anymore in a couple months. Like, if somebody asks me this, and that particular person I know is living with their fiance, girlfriend, or whatever, and that particular person I know gets drinks to drunkenness regularly, or that particular person I know has something in their life that if they were a church-going person, that the church wouldn't tolerate if they knew about it. In other words, I really don't think this person is a Christian spiritually. They're obviously one culturally. That's why they're asking a minister to marry them. I would always want to say no. Not to pass judgment on that person, not to be mean to that person, but to make a statement about who I am as a Christian. Because this is what I would say, and I just would like, you know, I want you guys to think through this. What would you want your pastor to say? Because if you're coming to me, like, I'm not a judge. You could obviously go to the judge. You're coming to me. And usually you're probably coming to me because I'm your friend and I care about you and you care about me. If it's somebody you personally know. Now, I know there's probably people who just walk up to XYZ church in town and they never go there. And you're like, Pastor, can you marry us? And then the pastor has to make a decision. But where it comes down for me is, like, if you're asking me to marry you, it's because you know, like, I'm the churchy guy. I'm licensed to minister. And I wouldn't be unless I had this particular set of Christian values. I have a very particular set of values. And I have this set of Christian values. And if you don't share them, I'm not the guy to marry you. Because if you're not living by these values, you're not going to have a successful Christian marriage. Now, you might get married and stay married for 50 years until you die. Or you might get divorced. I don't know. But when the world asks God's people to marry them, I think God's people or God's person, whoever the case may be, this person endorsed by some church, needs to sit and say, listen, I'm flattered. I'm not against you getting married, but maybe it's better for you to go to the judge because we don't share the same values. I'm just somebody who can sign the paper. Do you want somebody who shares your values or somebody who can sign the paper? Now, that's one way of thinking of it. And again, remember, we're operating outside of any kind of specific biblical prohibition or proscription or prescription. We have to apply a broad general ethic. I mean, another argument could be, this is a chance for me to get up before these people and all their family and friends and proclaim the gospel and proclaim God's design for marriage to them. They've asked me to do it, and I'm going to do it. It's like today when I was asked to pray. It's a Veterans Day lunch. I mean, I think some people might give more of a generic secular prayer. No, I'm saying Jesus. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you for these veterans. Yes, let's honor these veterans. Thank you for our freedom, that kind of thing. But I'm going to end that prayer. Most of all, thank you for Jesus, in whose name I pray. Amen. If you're asking me to pray, I'll happily pray for you. And we're going to pray with Jesus in mind. It's going to be a specifically Christian prayer. And if you're going to ask me or Pastor so-and-so to marry you, it's going to be a specifically Christian wedding, whether you're Christian or not. So some people look at it as a chance to evangelize. Or you could look at it simply as a chance, like, I'm honored that somebody has asked me in this super important, intimate time in their lives to be a part of it, and I'm the one who got asked by this friend, almost like being asked to be a best man, to perform this wedding. So I'm just going to do it to be nice, because it's the right thing to do to be nice. So what would you do, or what would you have your pastor do? These are all things to think through, because they have repercussions on how we're supposed to love people, how we're supposed to treat other people, and what we expect of other people and what they expect of us. And that's the interesting thing in culture, especially when you live in a sort of pseudo-Christian culture. How do you handle things? Thanks for listening to The Christian Commute. Lord willing, I'll be back with you again tomorrow. As always, God bless. And as always, remember, Christianity is not about getting saved. It's about being saved. Oh, I think my wife... Oh, I was about to grumble about my wife locking me out of the house. I bet we're going to find out. God bless you guys.
Thanks for listening to The Christian Commute. Please send your questions about Christian apologetics and theology to sethdunn88@gmail.com. If you are not a Christian, please remember that you can be reconciled to God through the shed blood of His Son, Jesus Christ. The Bible teaches that all who call on the name of the Lord will be saved. Repent of your sins now and accept Jesus as Lord. God bless.